This is a tape. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
That's what it is. Great. That's good that you got it.
What did you have for breakfast this morning? I don't remember.
I'd have to stop and think.
I would. And the story, you see, one of the issues we're going to face down the pike is I really believe the autobiography has possibilities, much greater possibilities together as the story of the two. She's a girl, I think, that her story would be minimized in the larger story because she doesn't know the way great autobiography is.
Right.
But her story alone would stand. So we have, I think, that fallback. And I'm hoping that as she begins to see how integrated your lives are, there's a way to tell her the total story and not minimizing any part. Do you have a feeling about that?
No. She's had the...
Start right there. During
the period when I commanded the Arnold J. Isbell, 1955 to 1957, one of the things that won kudos for me was that we had a much higher retention of reserve officers than did any neighboring destroyer, and she was a very key part of that because of the big sistering she did of the wives, the young wives of the officers who were having to make that decision as to whether or not to make a career out of it. A significant direct contribution, when I was a flotilla commander, she did the same thing with the wives of the skippers, and when I was chief of naval operations, she did a lot of things with regard to organizing special things for the wives, particularly to try to bring in the minority wives. Got a Congressman, Ben Gilman, who is still now a very senior member of Congress and was then a freshman, to teach a class on how Congress works and for wives. And so she's made a tremendous contribution all the way along.
Well, that's what I'm hoping for, that as it evolves, that she'll feel more and more comfortable, that she, first of all, she can trust me with that part of the story.
Right. I think what we probably need to do, Mel, is once this, we don't even have to wait for the board to approve the contracts. We need to get maybe my attorney son Jim to draft a parallel contract that would be between you and Musa and me for the book involving her, with a financial arrangement that is mine, not the National Marrow Donor Program's.
Well,
I just am really goosey about not being accused in any way of using the organizations to in any way enhance a book about Musa, you know.
Even though
I'm
inevitably have something to do with this, the great goals of this organization.
Yeah, it's true.
And lead
true.
To their enhancing.
Yeah.
But absolutely, that would be fine. But you see, the women's books are really big if they are written truly like a woman.
Yeah. Can you put on your female hat?
When I was first a ghost, I was producing for public broadcasting some stuff, and they came to me and said, "Would you write a book for Dale Evans?" And I said, "Roy Rogers and Dale Evans? Yes. She wants to write a book about what it means to be a Christian woman." And I said, "Are you kidding me?" And they said, "No, but she's prepared a lot of material for you," and they brought me 4 pages from Dale, and said that that's what they would like me to build this book on, what it means to be a Christian woman. So I'm wondering, I'm pretty good at affecting a style, and I think your wife has her own incredible style. And to let the book really, for yesterday, for example, I said, "Now talk to me about Shanghai and when you met the Admiral." And she said, "You mean, but he's me." And I said, "I'll explain the difference." And she did, and it's so winsome.
Yeah.
Because it's not only a woman's perspective,
Right.
The cultural
aspect. That's right. And I think even some of her malapropisms ought to be in, don't you? Because it's...
Yeah, you've heard some.
Oh, yeah, sure.
She's great.
Yeah.
I don't know whether she does it on purpose.
The children and I have made it a point never to correct her because we just love it so much, you know, which is unfair, but...
she got some on tape that were just a choice. I don't know how many you can read in. Well, do you want me to talk to him directly about that, or do you want me just to prepare a little letter that he could use to...
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Because I don't think it would take much money, but we should just make a little separation. It would probably be better for the whole thing to have it clear.
All right.
Talk to me a little bit about how much the Agent Orange thing has gotten your interest in the Marrow thing.
Totally.
It was trace the connection kind of
from Elmo, who was a very brilliant and meticulous fellow, researched personally every transplant center, and we visited three of them, Stanford, Dana-Farber up in New York, and Fred Hutchinson, as the three that he boiled down to as the best in the country. And by all odds, Fred Hutchinson stood out in our minds as the single most important. So that's where we went. There, we were terribly fortunate in that in this rotating attending physician sequence, Don Thomas happened to be, who was in charge of the overall transplant clinic, happened to be the attending physician for most of the period that Elmo was there. So we developed a very close association with him. I go jogging in the morning and come in at the end of the jog in my sweat clothes to chat with Elmo, and Don Thomas would almost always be there at 6:30 in the morning. We both developed a tremendous reverence for him. This was before he had become the Nobelist. And so then Don Thomas called me a year or so later and said, would you please join the board of the National Marrow Donor Program? Describe it. Musa and I had been in our own minds kind of searching for what was the right way to, in our own, at least in our own milieu, memorialize Elmo. And this seemed like a natural to make this contribution in his memory rather than some brick-and-mortar thing. And since he had a transplant, even though it was from a family member, not an unrelated one, or maybe even because of that, we were very aware of the fact that only 25% of the people who need a transplant are fortunate enough to have that match. We remembered the terrible period we went through while waiting for all of us to be typed to see if there was a match. And and how excited Musetta was when she was the one, and how disappointed Jim and Anne were that they were not the ones that were the match. We understood in full measure what a family goes through that doesn't have that match, and that when there are possible donors out there who do match, that they ought to be found. So it was that relationship.
Then trace the connection, the one jump farther, to the consortium of radiation-induced injuries.
In the course of a visit to the Soviet Union, which came about because I was chairing the National Marrow Donor Program, and I wanted to see if we could bring the Russians in to a relationship with us.
For the donor networking,
I arranged to have the visit sponsored by Dr. Vorobyev. I paid for our trip. I did not go at Merrill Foundation's expense or Merrill Program's expense. There wasn't a foundation there because it was such a long shot. But Dr. Vorobyev acted as the sponsor and was our host, broke down the red tape for us and so forth. And I became absolutely fascinated with his story. Here was a guy who had been fighting almost single-handedly a battle ever since the 86 Chernobyl explosion. That was then 3 years later, and was getting nowhere. And it clearly was a way of tying in the relationship between our Marrow interests in helping him get this thing started. I found that there was a reasonable amount of interest in doing that among the Marrow board, and so that's what led to the continuing collaboration.
Radiation-induced injuries and Marrow transplant, there's a definite connection there, too, right? That
yes.
The primary injury requires Marrow transplant treatment.
That's right, and if, for example, the ones who are heavily enough exposed that their marrow is destroyed are in essence like the cancer patients whose marrow has been deliberately destroyed. And if the radiation is not so extensive, has not so extensively damaged the organs, a transplant can save the life. There's a spectrum in there. You know, some would be so severely damaged organ-wise that it wouldn't work. Some won't need the transplant because the marrow has survived, albeit taking it down temporarily. But there is a group in there in that spectrum that can use a transplant. If you had every worker typed and a donor identified, you could, in an emergency, respond rather rapidly to those in that spectrum that could use the transplant.
Is it too far-fetched to say the connection with the international intrigue thriller that one of the reasons you and Verbiev are uniting to create that donor network is also part of being ready for radiation-induced injury?
Certainly is true in my case, and I believe it to be the case with Dr. Verbiev.
That basically we can say this all ties together as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the Verbiev friendship.
No.
The radiation and Agent Orange and the poisoning of people's bodies and the need for marrow transplant, all of that has to do with the possibilities of
right.
a nuclear accident.
That's right.
And the network is another way of getting ready.
That's right.
That's not too far.
No.
Okay. Do you remember the place that you met Verbiev?
Yes, he came to the airport in Moscow to meet us. So I remember it very well.
Was he alone, or was Nikita?
No, Nikita was with him.
Already?
Yeah.
So Nikita's been a part of this from the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
He's a major source.
Yes, he is. And of course, Verbiev speaks almost no English, so you have to have Nikita there anytime he and I are together.
And so Nikita has become a kind of a person, persona.
That's right.
And he's so interesting a persona,
yeah.
It would almost be someone we'd want to include.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As an aside, which I wouldn't want to use, you know, neither Muzin nor I cared for him on the first contact. And we're trying now to understand why, because we're just very devoted to him now. But in that first series of meetings, I think it was because maybe he was so uptight. He was just always kind of in there in a very prodding, insisting manner, and we were irritated by him. Now we love the guy.
Interesting. Do you remember any incidences, like, was he pushing?
To get you on schedule or do it was that kind of thing, you know. I guess the best explanation of what he was up to was he just wanted the thing to work so well that he was hovering over us like a maiden aunt, you know. We don't understand ourselves now because we're just so fond of him, and he's just a delightful human being, you know.
He grew on me. Now the first time I was here for the dinner, he was flown in.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, we're all waiting for this. You know, I mean, I didn't verbalize it, but this guy comes off in jeans and a shirt.
Yeah, strange looking.
And then he's going, but now I just sense he's alive.
Yeah. Yeah. And his family, you know, were part of the Refusnik crowd. There were members of his family who were in the resistance.
All along.
Yeah.
Will she have for me addresses and phone numbers in Russia, like of Nikita?
I'm not sure that she will, but Dick MacDonald talks to him every day. Yeah, practically every day.
Really?
Yeah, because of this liaison on the consortium.
Okay, so he's holding the countries together.
Right.
The places that you visited that were most meaningful to you on that trip, that was the main trip. Then you went back to Briansk.
Yes, on the trip.
The first trip. Was that just in Moscow?
Well, the very first trip we made was just to Moscow, and that was not the one that was sponsored by Vorobyov. That first trip, I went as a member of the International Security Council, along with a number of other... I'm not sure which trip came first, as I reflect back now. We went once as a member of the International Security Council, where there were 8 or 10 military, and we met with a group of Soviet military at a former communist resort lodging 20 miles outside Moscow, and Moose's dear friend from Khabarovsk came to that meeting. Flew all the way across to be with us. And then another meeting was the one that Vorobyov sponsored, where we not only were with him in Moscow, but on that trip we went to Leningrad, to Rostov, to Omsk, and to Khabarovsk, all the way across. And that was clearly the one that Vorobyov sponsored. Moose's high school classmates ended up roughly half escaping to the West, like Musa did, by virtue of going to Shanghai or elsewhere, and then moving on. The other half were scooped up. Some volunteered, and others were forced to go back to Russia. Most of them were perished in the gulags or in the Virgin Lands programs. About, to the best of my knowledge and belief, about 5 survived. On that trip that Vorobyov sponsored, and the more I talk about it, the more I think that was the first trip. We had a classmate of Moose's from Australia had visited us and had the telephone number and address of Mila, Moose's closest girlfriend, in Khabarovsk over near Vladivostok. Moose had no contact for 45 years because it would have been a death knell for any of them to hear from the wife of a military man, so we didn't even try. But by that time, Glasnost had started, picked up the phone and got through on the first dial. It's never happened since. And Moose, after 45 years, talked to Mila Penjakova in Khabarovsk, which incidentally is the hometown of Moose's family. Originally, Habarova, the father, the great 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 grandfather, founded Habarovsk, and Moose's mother and aunt were Habarovna. And
they went from there to
Habin? Moose's father, when he married her mother, took her to Blagoveshchensk, which is somewhat to the west of Khabarovsk, on Lake Baikal, and that's where they spent their married life, and they escaped from Blagoveshchensk. But the family had properties in both Blagoveshchensk and Khabarovsk.
So when they went back to reclaim some of their fortune or whatever they had left, that's where they went to the first city.
No. Well, in the last year or so, Moose's cousin in Seattle has done some nosing around to see if they can identify where the original properties were, and I think they now know approximately what part of the city they were in. Russia hasn't proceeded to the point like some of the Eastern European satellites where people can file claims for reclaiming their original properties.
But that trip then was primarily to visit Moose's friends.
Yeah, so, well, no. Damn it, no. It was the trip with the International Security Council that... I've got to talk to Moose about the sequence, because on that first trip, we got through by phone to Mila in Khabarovsk. She agreed to come to Moscow to meet Moose. When she arrived, unbeknownst to us, she had been able to persuade another girlfriend, classmate from Rostov, and two of Moose's high school beaus, a doctor from Omsk and a fellow who headed a soccer association from Chelyabinsk in the Urals. And that has an interesting tie into this radiation interest, to come with her. They all formed up for the first time in years in Moscow, and the five of them had the damnedest gab fest you've ever seen. The two boyfriends showed up with huge bouquets of flowers. It was just a very sweet and poignant thing. And then at that meeting, at the end of that 3 days, they all made us promise that we would come back in a year and visit them and their spouses in their homes. The spouses didn't come on that trip because of expense to travel. So it was the second trip, it was definitely the second trip then that we made the junket through all those places, but that also, I believe, is the one that Vorobyov sponsored.
We'd like you to work it both ways.
So we visited and lived in the homes for 4 or 5, 6 days in each of these places, Rostov, Omsk, and Khabarovsk, with our classmates. The classmate from Chelyabinsk had to come to Omsk because we were not given permission to go to Chelyabinsk. Subsequently, we learned that that's because of the series of radiation accidents they've had there over the years. And when this male classmate showed up with his second wife and daughter, she very obviously is a child who has suffered from the radiation exposure. She's got some kind of a nervous tic problem, and she's got eyes that are have very bad vision, and is clearly the result of and some neurological things that are clearly the result of exposure, probably in the womb. Yeah, Chelyabinsk has been written up as the scene of several radiation explosions. Yeah.
Okay. Wow, that's really interesting. What a tangled web.
Yeah.
Locations. The location that you visited in the Soviet Union that are related to the or to Russia, to the radiation induced injuries, are there primary hospitals that become places or locales for us, or governmental agencies? Is the Politburo a place where...
The key things are the Ministry of Health, which Vorobyov headed for several years and just left a few months ago. But his primary base before and after and even during, indirectly, is the what used to be called the All-Union Center of Hematology. It's now called the Institute of Hematology, the Russian Institute of Hematology, I guess. Those are the two key organizational entities. We had our first meeting of the consortium in Bryansk because that was the closest Russian city to Chernobyl. Gomel in the Ukraine is closer, but it's not a Russian city. And yeah, because the radiation in some areas has pretty well expired. The doctors didn't seem worried about us being in Bryansk.
That's how many miles away?
Can't tell you.
So, Briansk is the closest Russian city.
Right.
What institute did you meet there?
Well, there we stayed at a lodge that had used to be a communist vacation lodge, and we visited a hospital in Briansk, which was the principal hospital. Some of the scientists from that hospital and from the Briansk area who will have to do the data collection were in attendance at our meeting, but we weren't really sponsored by a hospital there. Vorobyov's Ministry of Health really sponsored us.
Would you have good access to the Ukraine and the city near Chernobyl?
We wouldn't have had until this Houston meeting. I think we now do as a result of the attendance of those senior scientists from the Ukraine and the Belarus.
Talking like that through their interpreter about how the project they were working on. So I thought maybe something would be visible. I don't know what being on site at Chernobyl would cause in terms of it's like going to Jonestown and going to Winkle.
Yeah.
Like sometimes visiting the location is helpful.
Right.
Other locations in Washington, D.C., where the action takes place regarding the issues that you're concerned with. Department of Energy.
Yes, the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute.
Where is that?
It's in Bethesda. Interestingly enough, the National Maradona Program gets monies from two sources, from the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute, called NHLBI, and from the Navy. The history of that was that originally the director of NHLBI at that time was not willing to sponsor this work. He considered marrow transplantation apparently highly research-oriented and not a very practical technique, and so he refused to sponsor it. When Senator the senator who was so close to President Reagan from Colorado, Laxalt. When Senator Laxalt got interested in this, they refused in that part of the executive branch to sponsor it. The Navy was willing to, so the original monies that were appropriated were given to the Navy to set up this marrow program. After a year or two, the director of NHLBI left. Dr. LaFont came. He was willing to take it over. So the program was transferred from the Navy to NHLBI. There then began to be some bureaucratic problems between their desire to totally manage us and our desire to have a little more freedom to run this program in what we thought was the most appropriate way to bring it quickly to fruition. So we arranged to get money put back in the Navy program, and we now have two sources, which has really been great, because if we have a little bit of a bureaucratic problem on one side, we can get it dealt with on the other side. The Navy's been much more administratively flexible. So you've got Captain Robert Hartzman, who is we call him our Pope on the Navy side, and Dr. LaFont and his assistant for this purpose, Dr. Paul McCurdy over in NHLBI, that's our Pope on that side.
One Pope's better.
Yeah, well, it helps to have two, because you can play one against the other.
How Machiavellian.
But it's interestingly enough, when Dr. Vorobyov was going to make a visit here a year or so ago, and I still had not been able to put anything together that was getting us started on this radiation effort, I called Dr. LaFont and told him that Vorobyov was coming and I would like to sign a protocol with among as many institutions as I could. He indicated a willingness to sign for NHLBI. Navy was willing to sign. But LaFont further said, there's a Dr. Armin Weinberg down in Texas who's been after me to get something going. Why don't you talk to him? So I'd never heard of Armin Weinberg. I called him. He was interested. So I set up a meeting in Denver, since we were headed for a board meeting in Fort Collins, at which we signed a protocol with Texas Methodist, Baylor College, Weinberg signing. I signed for the Merrill Foundation. Bob Graves signed for the program, so we'd have two different names. He was vice chairman at the time. LaFont ultimately signed for NHLBI. He couldn't get to Denver. Captain Hartzman signed for the Navy. And subsequently, and Dr. Vrobioff signed for the Ministry of Health and for the Hematological Center. Subsequently, I think there have been one or two other signatures, and we hope to have a Belarus and a Ukrainian signature.
And this is on what?
It's a protocol that says we have banded together to form an effort to research for the research and treatment of radiation-induced injury.
Okay, that's in your packet. That's
right.
In the packet of Houston.
Right.
Okay, and that's the document that's giving you the gold document.
That's right.
Consortium.
Right. It's been refined since initially it was about a three-sentence statement that I dictated at the last minute, and we got everybody to sign at Denver. But this latest thing lays out our specific goals, and it's an enlargement of that. Well, with luck, if we can get the money for it, we'll have some data coming in on the health effects of the exposure at Chernobyl, and we will be able to get more immediate results. The next time there's a TUMS-7, hopefully we'll be able to have people go right over to start collecting data. And more importantly than anything else, to me as an operator, is the objective of having a generic plan and having everybody who is associated with the areas where you could have a potential accident knowledgeable, prepared, and ready to deal with it, with pre-stocked supplies as much as that is feasible and so forth. Yeah. Yeah, right. One, I think, would have to visualize that the real best expertise would be from a SWAT team working for our consortium, trained and ready to go, and that their first objective would be to begin to train as rapidly as possible everybody in the immediate area to deal with it, because you'll never be able to afford to train everybody everywhere for the possible accident.
Nor to equip them.
Right.
Are there key people here besides that who have worked, besides your immediate people, who are historic figures in the struggle with being prophetic about nuclear radiation issues? The Fermis and the Einsteins that had to do with power and splitting the atom, but what about anybody along the way?
There are people in the environmental movement who have screamed for years in a what always seemed to me to be rather fanatical way about the horror of potential accidents. I must say I find myself feeling they're less and less fanatical as time goes on. But I guess the only sort of significant name that comes to mind is the 90-year-old Nobelist. Teller's not concerned about nuclear explosion. I don't think he stands out. Linus Pauling.
Yeah, he's an
able
one.
Is he?
Yeah.
I believe he has warned a lot about the prospect.
Okay. Yeah, well, he wasn't talking about vitamin C. He was talking about his grandson, Bladen, my son. But any over in the Soviet Union or Russia that...
I think Vrobioff is probably the only serious one.
Where were you in 86 when Chernobyl went off? And do you remember anything about your response those days?
I remember being deeply concerned about what was going to happen to the people who were exposed. And
retired at the time.
I'd been retired for 12 years and was in the Washington area doing essentially the kinds of things that I do except for the NMDP business. I guess I was just, I'd have to check the files to see what date I actually joined the NMDP. Son Elmo died in 88, August 13th of 88, and I joined before he died. I may have been on the board, but I believe I went on the board after the Chernobyl thing, so my involvements then would have been as president of Admiral Zumwalt Consultants, a member of 12 or 14 boards of directorships, chairman of the Phelps Stokes Fund, which is a pro bono activity, and chairman of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, which is a pro bono activity.
Are you trying to get a whole other life?
Well, I've just, at the end of 19 years, given up chairmanship of the Phelps Stokes Fund just this week. I'd had that for 10 years, and I told him I just had to drop that one because I'm getting too much involvement in this. They're so thoroughly intertwined that it's hard to contemplate giving them up. The chairmanship of the Merrill Foundation helps me raise money for both the foundation and the consortium. Chairmanship of the program is what gives me kind of the substantive seminal input about what's going on in the transplant field. So it's hard to visualize At the time, may well come when I would give up chairmanship of the program to concentrate on the money raising at the foundation and chairing the consortium. But for the next year or two, at least, I need to do all three.
Tell me a little bit about your shame.
I don't know whether you've read the book. Long watch. The letter that I wrote to my dad, you know, tells it better than I would remember it at this point.
That's a great source.
Yeah, it is. Fortunately, my dad saved it all those years and sent it to either Dick McDonald or Mike Spiro when I was CNO and told him to save it and give it to me when I retired. Which is the only way I would have still had it, you know. So that's the detail, as I described in the book, you know.
I was just curious. You don't seem to be a person who would act that fast on that big a deal, getting married.
I've always been a fast decision maker.
Decision maker, yes, yeah. But you're also very thoughtful.
Yeah.
This had no thought behind it. This was total visceral.
I was totally captivated by my decision.
You couldn't even speak her language.
No, she spoke English, but much more brokenly than she does now, but perfectly understandable.
And probably
that's right. And I had started studying Russian the last few months of the war to get ready for the post-war environment. It was clear that we were either going to have an awful lot of relationships with the Russians because they would be friends, or more likely because they would be enemies. I was of the latter school, and that seemed like a good career enhancing thing to do.
To
study Russian. So when I met her, the excuse I used to see her right away next day was, would you start teaching me Russian? And I came every day. I'm not sure it will be in the book, but I would take a two-hour lesson and then take her to lunch, and then after lunch I would tell her that I had to go see the Admiral. And then a few days later I proposed, and I didn't go see the Admiral anymore. And then we were married, and on our honeymoon we were dancing at the Club Argentina, and a woman who I always describe as a gorgeous-looking Eurasian danced by and said, "Allo, Captain." I was captain of the prize crew ship. And I said, "Good evening." Musa said, "Who was that?" And I said, "That, sweetheart, was the admiral." Yeah, have you asked Priscilla about
that and then the key to the dress?
That's the wrong number. The executive assistant to the Secretary of the Navy. Paul Nitze had been Assistant Secretary of Defense, was appointed to be Secretary of the Navy. I was working for Paul in his first hat, and I came down to the Navy with him. A few months later, Bill came in as public affairs expert, as a captain in the Navy. So we were together through the Paul Nitze milieu, and then during that period, at the end of that period, I was selected to be an admiral. We were at a dinner party at the home of a Rear Admiral Mack, who was then the Chief of Navy Information. And the announcement hadn't come out yet, but Admiral Mack knew, because the selection list has to go through the Chief of Information before it goes to the White House. It has to come through the office of the Secretary of the Navy, so both Bill and I and the attorney in the office, the Navy lawyer, knew about it, but none of us legally could talk about it. And so the attorney, Robbie Robertson, and Bill Thompson and I were huddled behind a stairwell having a martini and talking about this. And Bill said, "Bud, how long is it going to take you to make CNO? I took another drink and said, 5 years. And he said, what are you going to do when you become CNO? I said, I'm going to make you Chinpo, and I'm going to make you JAG. And I'll be damned if 5 years later I was not CNO. And I made Bill Chief of Information, and Robbie Robertson Judge Advocate General in time. He had started out as deputy.
Invite me to
Martini. So, you know, it's one of those kind of dumb things that turns out to be prophetic. So Bill was then, and he's just a superb communicator, and although interesting, he's rather introverted in personality, and is not by no means loquacious, but he's just got great judgment in the PR business. And so he was with me all through the 4 years as Chief of Information, and was there for all the successes and all the trials and tribulations. Yeah, since 30 years ago.
Now, whatever happens, I really feel committed.